Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 25. And this is with UK Column. I'm here with Brian Gerrish, Alex Thompson, and David Scott from UK Column. And Brian, why don't you introduce UK Column to people who might not be aware of it?
Certainly. Thank you for that, and thank you for the invitation tonight. UK Column, I usually describe as a community news outlet. We started as a printed paper. We printed over a million copies, and that was all done with volunteer help, a very small group of people. What we printed was done on the basis of donations raised. But as time went on, it was obvious that the printed edition meant that you couldn't keep up with what was happening. And with a huge amount of effort by Mike Robinson, we were able to move across into producing a daily live video news, and we do that Monday to Friday. So we can now say that more or less we're multimedia. We're not printing the hard copy, but we are producing the news program. We're producing investigatory programs on a number of subjects, which child abuse has been one of the key ones, and we're also doing a number of audio interviews via dispatches, and of course we have done work with other organizations. So I would call ourselves a community news organization.
That's very interesting. Which subjects, you mentioned child abuse there, which other subjects are common on UK Column?
Well, certainly in the early days, what came to the surface very quickly was corruption. That was part of my personal journey as well, looking at what was happening in the city of Plymouth in UK, where we were looking at large amounts of public money clearly being misappropriated. So fraud and corruption within the local authority system, that was a key part of it. And once we started to talk on that subject, then other people contacted us. And child stealing was one of the early subjects where parents were coming to us and saying that their children had been taken by social services and by false pretenses, false evidence in court, false documents. And we followed up on some of those early cases. We certainly checked all the evidence that the parents were bringing to us, and found that what they were saying was absolutely correct. And that subsequently led to us going into court with some of those families to see and experience for ourselves what happens in a family court. But it was later when I did a talk at one of Ian Crane's AV Alternative View events in Bristol, and I talked on the subject of child stealing and child abuse. That's when the floodgates opened. And I was really swamped by the number of people coming to me, telling me what had happened to them, and a lot of them asking for help, which I have to say at that stage, I simply could not give them. But that was the start of a learning process. And at about the same time, I was also investigating the political charity Common Purpose. And it's very interesting that here we are in 2017, and those paths are merging, because we're seeing that many of the things causing breakdown across UK at the moment, we can also track back to the change agents, such as Common Purpose itself.
That is very interesting. I remember what I was saying to you before we went on air. I was watching your videos, I think it was a full 10 years ago. I think it was 2007. Definitely around about then. And it was a very... might have been 2008 and 9, definitely by then. But it was a fascinating thing. I mean, we can get into that later. But for now, I'd like to bring David into the conversation and ask him how he would describe UK Column.
Well, it's an avenue to get messages out. It's very much alternative news. It's not beholden to anybody. And it allows people to people like ourselves to assemble a case and put it out before a reasonably large audience without it being controlled really in any way other than by the requirement to do our homework thoroughly and well. It's an avenue for quite a lot of people who don't have a voice to find a voice.
That's useful. And Alex, what would you say about this?
Well, the chat room's already said a couple of things. These guys have seen a lot of shit. Must be disappointing to see their civilization turn to shit before their eyes. Well, we don't usually swear at UK Column, but actually, that's spot on. And a number of people in the chat room have said, oh, these guys only bang on about common purpose. Well, no. We talk about networks of control, influence, and change. That's how I got involved. I was a GCHQ intelligence officer from 2001 to 2009. That's the British Signals Intelligence Agency, the equivalent of NSA. I was never happy with the political culture of the civil service. Even when I joined, I told the vetting officer that. I left to marry a Dutch girl, and I live in the Netherlands now, and I work freelance. And it was sleepless nights about the condition of the country that brought me in. And so I volunteered myself to Brian Gerrish, initially offering translation help as he was looking to equivalent developments in other countries reported in the news in foreign languages. But that's what we have concentrated on. Some of the big themes we report on are very much overlapping with alt-rights and identitarian themes, actually. And we do share audiences. Comments in YouTube chats make that quite obvious, particularly the breakdown of law and order, sexualization of children, control rings within particularly local governments. There's a guy called Martin Edwards on our website. You'll find a series of his articles. If you go to the ukcolumn.org website and go to the series option on the menu, you'll find one called One World Governance. And that's largely a series written by Martin Edwards, a Welsh writer of ours. And he talks in detail about the common purpose effect, as he calls it. In fact, that's the name of the series. Sorry, One World Governance is not a series. And he talks about how one of your major themes from the early days, Wos, which is Rochdale, which is repeated across the whole belt of northern and midland towns, and now Glasgow as well, closer to home to you. These were enabled. Okay, yes, there were Pakistani gangs having their way, and you have acknowledged, and others have too, like Pat Condell, that these were enabled and almost, yes, fomented and encouraged by white council leaders, usually of the Labour Party networks, but it was a one-party state in many of these places. But what we find is that a parallel with that, and particularly in David Scott's part of the country in Scotland, that's the worst form of it, there are entirely white child abuse setups going on. We reported on one called the Dochertys, where an estate in the northeast of Scotland, which is the absolute epicentre of satanic ritual abuse in the world, let alone Britain. In the northeast of Scotland, we didn't have hard evidence of Satanism there, but we had a lot of detailed reporting there about how a family was targeted because they didn't allow their disabled four-year-old son to be abused. And this was by the high and mighty, and it went right to the top of the British and Irish states because they fled to both jurisdictions in Ireland, the Republic and Northern Ireland, and found that there was total control of the judiciary there by the Brits and especially the Scots. And this is a wider theme, you see, that Scots, particularly through their success in money-making and business and through their Freemasonry, have penetrated the entire English-speaking world. And I'm afraid to say that they have brought a particularly virulent form of satanic ritual abuse, including the manners, the tools to shut this down by telling people that it doesn't exist and you're ridiculous to talk about it. That has an epicentre in Scotland, and from there it spreads its tentacles out to the low countries.
I think a lot of people will be surprised to hear that.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Since you've brought it up, how would you, or the others, Brian or David, how would you define Satanism?
Well, that's one for Brian, I think, in the first instance. He's got the widest view of the matter.
Well, it's a very, very interesting question. What is Satanism? I think we have to consider the views of the people who say that they actually worship Satan. And perhaps a good place to start with that, maybe some of your audience is saying, well, this is simply not real. So my response to that will be, well, it certainly is real, because the Royal Navy a few years ago, and this was published by the BBC.
And so you're a former Royal Navy officer, you should say.
I'm a former Royal Navy officer of quite a few years ago now. But if you search for the BBC Royal Navy and Satanism, you will find that the Ministry of Defence, the British Ministry of Defence, approved Satanism as a religion which could be practised on board British warships. So I don't need to prove whether Satanism is real, because the British government has said that it is real, and the British government finds that the worship of Satan is acceptable on board British warships. If you start to talk to survivors of some of this horrific abuse. Of course, what many of them will say is, well, actually, it isn't the worship of Satan, it's the worship of Lucifer. And nevertheless, the same principles apply, that children are then horrifically abused.
Well, actually, that's an interesting thing in itself. What is the distinction between Lucifer and Satan?
Well, Lucifer is, and especially if you read the Bible, but you don't have to be persuaded by the Bible, because at the lowest level, this is in the minds of the worshippers. Lucifer is Satan appearing as an angel of light to deceive people. And it's particularly a common form, a popular form of satanic worship among the elite, bankers in particular, who shape the nations through money creation and money flows. And Lucifer appears to these people. Some of them he talks to directly, or to keep it on the psychological plane, they perceive that he speaks to them directly. And he whispers in their ear that if I could just undo morality, Judeo-Christian morality, and I know I'm going to get flack in an alt-right chat room for saying that, but there are people who maintain that there is such a thing. Then Lucifer says to these people, there will be a glorious apparition, the world will be as one world government, and everyone can be what they want sexually, and indulge all their appetites. So that's why Aleister Crowley talked about, do what thou wilt shall be the hope of the Lord. So that is, it's an elite form in which you're not like a biker, you know, saying hail Satan and making a big fuss about, corrupting the children. You do it in a much more subtle form, and you do it with the best of evil intentions, because you think that what you achieve will be worth it all, a beautiful kingdom in which this angel will rule. That's the distinction I see it.
So we're talking about... David, you go.
I've just a couple of points for that. When I got involved with this, it was through visiting Robert Greene in prison. Robert Greene had been campaigning for a girl called Holly Gregg, who was a victim of abuse, including Satanist abuse.
I should just jump in and say, if people want to find out about Robert Greene, they should go to a video channel on YouTube called George Greek Trucker, and they'll find a lot of material about Robert Greene, including me reading some of his letters out. And there's also the Holly Gregg Justice blog. Or you can call Robert Greene directly. If you contact UK Column for his phone number, he's very open, and he'll talk to anyone to tell you about the reality of this evidence. He's got lots of it.
Yes, and that's what I went along. I followed his campaign. I knew what sort of man he was from YouTube videos, but I hadn't been involved. He was arrested from his home in Warrington by Police Scotland on grounds that were really unknown to him at the time. And he was taken up to Scotland to be locked up. But they'd opened a new jail up in Aberdeenshire, and like many new jails, there had been a riot. So these things take a while to settle in. And one wing of this had been completely trashed. So he ended up in my hometown in Perth. So I thought, well, I'll go along and visit him and give him a wee bit of company. And, of course, we're talking about the case, and he said, well, would you like to see the proof? I said, yes, I would. He said, okay, well, we'll get the documents sent to you. So I got all of these documents, which proved very much what had been said. So I started asking questions of the Scottish Government, and you don't get any answers. And the more the answers are refused, the more you get just the runaround, the more you realise they can't answer these perfectly reasonable questions. So I started to explore all of these issues, and I had no idea, for example, that things like Satanism were anything in Scotland, and started to discover that, yes, it actually was. There's a charity in Dundee that deals with this in a very concentrated way called Izzy's Promise. There's another one called Break the Silence in Kilmarnock that does the same. So I went along to see these people. I've had the stories. I've read the books written by the survivors, and it's very striking. It's very harrowing. It's not the country that you or I would have thought we were brought up in, or at least that aspect of it is completely alien to what we knew. And then when you get into the political aspects of this, you'll find that the following of these ideas of people like Blavatsky fall through things like Irish and Indian nationalism and a whole lot of political movements. So they have the political side as well. So it becomes quite an involved network. But at the core, they're pushing forward this Satanist idea, which is essentially you can become God. You can become as God.
You are a God.
Yes. Mm,
yeah.
And a big part of that, because a lot of people in the chat room here are going to be worried about race mixing, is indeed that there should be no nations, cultures, or races. that the man should be a blank slate. And that, just as a quick sidebar, that takes us across to the whole of the 20th century being a mind control effort in the Anglo-American establishment. And people will know about this, different aspects of this, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations and its use in US military intelligence. That's a deep and long story. Daniel Estulin is the best author on that. For clarity, I'll say he's a Lithuanian Ashkenazi Jew who was formerly in Soviet military intelligence. The chat room won't particularly like that, perhaps, but he speaks very clearly about this. And this Tavistock stuff was actually developed by British and American military intelligence types using, mostly Viennese Freudian psychological insights of a long pedigree. And and it also ties across to Edward Bernays. And the idea is you can suck the mind out of a whole group of people, a whole nation, make them a tabula rasa, a blank slate, and put a new post-national order in. This has very close tie-overs with the Frankfurter Schule, the fathers of progenitors of cultural Marxism, and the clients for this Tavistock doctrine and experiments, which have been conducted on the population without their knowledge for a long time, the clients for that are the leading banks, particularly the central banks, and above them the Bank for International Settlement, which is the central banker's central bank.
Right. For the sake of acknowledging this, somebody has said that Robert Greene is a convicted liar and pled guilty in 2015 at Aberdeen Court.
People should go to George Greene Crocker's channel and listen to my reading of Robert's letter. He's in communication with the Independent Press Standards Organisation, IPSO, about this, because the Daily Mail did a hatchet job on him. He was convicted of the Scots law offence of a breach of the peace, which a Scots constable, David will tell you more, can lift you for whenever he feels like it. He's wrongly been reported in the London press, which doesn't report Scots law properly, as if he were guilty of harassment. What he did was stand out as a parliamentary candidate for Aberdeen South, where most of Holly Gregg's alleged abusers, lived. And she names people, including a school principal, by the way, and a sheriff, a Scots judge. He went to campaign, and as part of his parliamentary pitch, he handed out flyers, was about to, saying, do you know what accusations have been made? And the point is, his leaflet said Police Scotland have deliberately never investigated any of these accused people, whom this girl with Down syndrome, as many of them do, named with perfect recall of detail and with no ability to frame. And many Down syndrome and other psychological experts independent of the matter confirmed that. That is what he was convicted for. Some tame Police Scotland, so it was Grampian Police then, tame policemen in the corruptest city in Britain and the most Satanist dominated went along and lifted him on orders for a breach of the peace, which I think I'm right in saying a Scots constable can do pretty much at his discretion. Conviction.
It's actually even worse than that, because the whole Robert Greene experience shows how exposed people can be in Scotland to official wrongdoing. Because when he was arrested, he was arrested in Aberdeen as a parliamentary candidate. Now that alone is quite unusual, right? He's standing for election for the Westminster seat, and he was arrested on, I think it was Friday, thrown in jail, left to sit there. Can I see a lawyer? No, this is Police Scotland, the Grampian Police. You're in Scotland now, laddie. We'll tell you when you see a lawyer. Just sit there. So he'd sit there, no access to a lawyer. That alone's a breach of his rights. And then when he started to be questioned the next day, they started talking about breach of an interdict, right? And Robert, being an Englishman, didn't even know what an interdict was, sussed out it was some sort of injunction, and still looked blankly at them. What injunction? That you were served with an interdict. Well, when? On Thursday. Well, where? At your home in Warrington. But I was in Aberdeen on Thursday. So he'd been arrested for breach of an interdict that had never been served. It then became a breach of the peace. And it then became a 500,000... No, was it 2 million? Yeah. What did he spend on it? Was it 2 million he spent on it?
Yeah, the Crown Office has admitted that.
£2 million breach of the peace trial, the most expensive breach of the peace trial in Scots history. And he got convicted, right? And he got a year, which is the maximum he could get in front of a judge. They'll never put Robert Greene in front of a jury. And a lot of people went to see this, and a lot of people were in that courtroom and considered that he really wasn't shown to have broken any law. But certain things came out of the trial, one of which was that of the 22 people that Holly Gregg had named, as abusers, none had even been questioned. So the government excuse is there's been a full and thorough investigation, there's insufficient evidence, the case is closed. But what is shown is that a full and thorough investigation consists of not even questioning the alleged perpetrators.
Which is a common tactic, because no investigation is results in no crime. And this is a pattern that we now see across a whole raft of different areas. It could be to do with people having their homes stolen or businesses taken away from them. But the tactic is that there is no investigation by the police, and then sometime later, it may be weeks or months, oh, well, there's no crime. But
And this is how corruption in Scotland is done. It's done quite subtly. It's done by everything being very tightly controlled, and obviously the Crown Office, even when there is sufficient evidence, some 60% of the cases are never progressed. So it's there's a lot of discretion there for the Crown Office to decide what to go ahead with and what not. So it means that the entire system is very opaque. The only oversight from the Crown Office, for the Crown Office, and it's also the head of the Crown Office, the Lord Advocate's a cabinet post, so there's political level influence as well. The only oversight is by an organisation that's headed by a 20-year veteran of the Crown Office that reports to the Lord Advocate, the head of the Crown Office. That's the oversight. So there's no oversight.
I can see that the detail has frustrated some of the chat room, that we're boring, that we're no fun, and we're talking about the nonsense. Well, if you're an 18 to 30 male, like most of WOS's viewers, I think, still are, be warned, because if the situation in your part of the world gets as bad as it is in the northeast of Scotland, you stand a high risk of being abducted at a Satanist festival and sacrificed alive. I'm serious. It's happened to a lot of them already.
Right, I see. Yeah, there are people. You've got to remember that the previous hangout, millennial hangout, was with Faith Goldie, and that was sort of pyrotechnic.
We're the big boys in a sense. We're not egotistically, but we've been through the mill. We've been in the establishment, and we know what this stuff is like. And if we say a word out of place, or if we're jocular about it, we'll be squashed. At least our credibility will be.
It's one of the big problems for us that, you know, people, when they are looking at alternative news sources, want to be entertained. And it's very hard to get across information that we would certainly say people need to know about, because if they don't know about it, they are going to be affected by it. You can't put it in a jovial way. If you're talking about the ability of the state to steal people's homes, or the ability of the state to steal people's children, you can't put it over in a jovial bonhomie way. You've got to get in there and talk about this subject as it is.
And if you're any kind of self-respecting ethno-nationalist, you're surely interested in who is stealing people's homes and children.
And who is running your country. This is where we come to very quickly, because the work that we've been doing over whatever it is now, 15 years for the UK column, shows us that we are being governed by an appalling set of people. Their values don't match the values of what we would say was the average person.
There's a Dutch academic called Dr. Tjeerd Andringa, who has coined the term kakistocracy for our current government system, which means rule by shits.
Right. Several people are... So you go.
Can I just press the point there that we are looking at a system of government where the party system is actually irrelevant. It's there as the puppet show. You can see it, you can touch it, you can see the colours, but actually that is not the system that is running the country. It's far deeper, it's much, much darker. And we are now at the state in UK where those people, or people amongst the governing elite, can decide that they are going to take your children, or they're going to take your home or your business or all of those things. And we are now seeing that investigation by the police doesn't happen, and justice in the courts does not happen. And that's a pretty serious state to be in. If that is happening, which it is without any question, then all of the other policy that government produces can be looked at and assessed on the basis, is it just policy, is it common sense policy, or is it malicious criminal policy?
Such as migration policy or the Home Office's policy on policing, you know, so things that are of core interest to you, Woz.
Oh, indeed. Several people have asked me to ask you about Jimmy Savile. Is he a sort of Jimmy freak?
Jimmy Savile went to the Knesset and boasted about it. UK Column is one of the few news outlets that is not expressly and across the board ethno-nationalist, which A, allows ethno-nationalists along with other persuasions to talk, and which B, talks about the conservative Friends of Israel and their French equivalent CRIF and their American equivalent AIPAC quite sincerely. And we talk about the judges and politicians who are in their pocket. A lot of Satanism, to enter the chat room, a lot of it personally does go back to Israel, but by no means all. And it did not originate in Israel or among the Jews before they had that state.
So this is not, this is one of those areas where we have to admit that it's our own people or our own elite who are doing, who are involved in this.
I think we have to ask another question, because when we look at what is happening, we look at the evidence on the table, perhaps we need to ask a question, are these our own people? Because what they do, what they say, their views, their values, their morality demonstrates to me that the people that we've got in power at the moment do not hold any of the basic values that I see. And I'm now, whatever I am, 63 years old, that in my lifetime I've seen in this country. We're seeing a totally alien set of values. But if we look at the people who are pushing those values across, what's interesting is that until fairly recently, the bulk of those faces were white. Then we've had change. We've had immigration. We now have people who are part of the government who are first or second generation from other countries, and it's been very interesting to see that some of those people, not all of them, but some of them, have now been absorbed into the same corrupt value set.
The Indians are particularly liable because of their the ones that are over here are high IQ and they're ambitious. And they love to get into winnable conservative seats. An example is Preeti Patel, who had to resign when she was found in the Golan Heights, talking about sloshing British aid money into hospitals which were treating effectively ISIS fighters and returning them back into Syria. So there you have the co-option of someone who's not even white British into an Israeli control network. But not all of them go that way. Some of them are Goyim, secular, Gentile, white British elite. And they have the same belief system as some of these corrupt minority of Jews who are in that system together with them.
If I could just throw in a comment at this point, the nature and the importance of the values and laws that define a nation. As I'm sure you're very well aware, in Scots history, there's a Declaration of Ardbroath from 1320 that records the wandering of the Scots nation all along the Mediterranean from the Levant through Spain, Ireland, and then into Scotland. And it makes it quite clear that it wasn't the ground they were on that made them a nation. It was the people and their laws and their customs and their values and the fact that they maintained that throughout their wanderings through other nations that they described as being wild and vicious. And if you lose those values and those laws, you very much lose something that's essential, much more so than mere real estate.
Now you have the opposite of Scots identity that you did in the past. It used to be the case that the Scots believed wherever they wandered, the group of people called the Scots would have Scottish values. And now the current Scottish National Party government, which is neither national nor Scottish, it's international Marxist, says as soon as you arrive on Scots soil, you are Scots.
Yeah, this is the magic soil thing. It applies to every Western country. You know, as soon as you arrive in...
It's magic soil with one... You're quite right, it is magic soil. It's, you know, what's required to be Scottish is to be in Scotland. But it's with one other proviso. And it's quite deceptive the way to describe it. It's you've got to be in Scotland and committed to Scotland. But what committed to Scotland actually means is committed to a particular left-wing, global, international socialist, politically correct, political agenda. And anyone who doesn't bow to that particular worldview will be treated as alien, even though they can be as Scottish ethnically as it's possible to imagine.
On Twitter, you get this all the time. If you don't like Scottish nationalism, fuck off to England, is what they say to you.
That does come up more than once, yes.
Yeah.
And the demonisation of what they call the Tories, whether these people support the Conservatives or not, is irrelevant. Anything that's even, I mean, it's not even right-wing, but even moderately centrist is viewed from this extreme left-wing position as being beyond the pale. And therefore, the requirements are twofold. It's magic soil, yes, you have to be across the line in the map, but it's also adherence to a particular set of values, not even immovable values, very much movable ones, and therefore a kind of surrender on an intellectual level.
And I will just throw in here that something which people correctly associate with a small number of Zionists now, this satanic set of values, predates modern Judaism and predates Zionism as any kind of entity, which doesn't arise till the late 19th century. You find it in ancient religions or offshoots thereof, any sacerdotal system. You'll find throughout history the idea of an elite, which, even if it's of the same blood as the people it rules over, regards itself as of a different class and order, and destined to enjoy these people sexually and the fruit of their labour and in any other ways, including the right to cull these populations and to set them to mindless labour and to mind control them. These are recurring themes throughout history, including of the Northern European peoples.
Mm. So to get back to Jimmy Savile, I mean, that was an interesting diversion there, but does Jimmy Savile factor into what we're talking about here?
I think he does, absolutely, because for the government and the establishment to say that nobody knew what that man was up to is a complete and utter lie. It's a ridiculous statement. It's obvious that individuals and a number of individuals within the government itself, but also within the wider establishment, had great concerns about what this man was doing. People tried to warn about what he was doing. So the key bit of the Jimmy Savile story for me is the fact that we've still got the situation where the same government, the same establishment, is denying the fact that they knew what this man was doing, but he was untouchable. And then you ask, why was he untouchable? Well, Jimmy Savile was repeatedly boasting that he was the fixer. He could fix things for people. And you see him alongside the royal family. You see him alongside Margaret Thatcher. You saw him alongside senior political figures or people operating the prisons. So this man had immense power. Why did he have immense power? Well, he was in the game of abusing children. And if you're in that game, you're part of an elite club. And what is that club about? Well, it's about self-gratification, enjoying the abuse of the children. But of course, with it also comes the ability to blackmail and control people. And if we just drift a little bit sideways from Jimmy Savile, we've got the BBC film clip that people can find very easily on YouTube, where you see the Tory whip, Tim Fortescue. This was a senior whip in the Tory party in 1973-74. This was the Ted Heath era. And that man says on camera, in a very relaxed way, that members of parliament would come to us, the whips, with problems. Those problems could be, little boys, and we fixed it for them. And then he said, and if you wonder why we did that, it may not sound very nice, but we did it so that, they owed us a favour and they would then do as we asked. So here we see a senior Tory whip on BBC film footage freely admitting that MPs were abusing children. They weren't reported to the police. They were blackmailed to follow whatever the policy was. So putting that man alongside Jimmy Savile, it becomes very, very easy to see that a man like Jimmy Savile, with an immense profile, an immense power by the number of people he knew, the dirty little secrets, he was allowed to carry on what he was doing.
And if you go one step forward, one step further from that to the realm of very high politics, you get Ted Heath, right? And Ted Heath was the man who gave away the sovereignty of the people and took us into the EU. And Ted Heath was in exactly the same position.
And what's interesting there is, if we want to talk about which nations or ethnic groups specialise in pederasty-based blackmail, yes, a lot of it is traceable back to Israel and Mossad, undoubtedly, but equally traceable back to Germany and in the Nazi era as well. So this technique emerges from Middle Europa and is exported by Zionism to Israel, a technique of controlling British and other politicians through having photographs of them doing unspeakable things, including allegedly Sir Leon Britton, who was the Britann, recently died, who was the Home Secretary in a crucial period of the Thatcher government and evidently helping to suppress a lot of this pederasty stuff.
And can I just add another example which people could research themselves? Christine Keeler died the last couple of weeks. If you read Christine Keeler was the prostitute at the heart of the Profumo affair. But if you read her book, which if I remember correctly, is called The Truth at Last, in there she talks about the good time girls who were having affairs, or they were having paid sex with members of the establishment and the politicians at that time. Profumo himself was caught up in it. But in it, she also says that, her handler, Stephen Ward,
yes,
was also procuring children.
Mm.
But that was only just a sort of two sentences in a whole book.
She was clever enough to know what to say. And the point of that was the secret spying cabal based at Cliveden, this estate outside London. Yes, it contained Jews. Yes, it was interested in US nuclear deployments in West Germany. That's what the critical idea was. It was just around the time of the JFK assassination in the same year, 63. So all of these elements and the fact that Ben-Gurion supposedly ordered JFK's assassination, these excite alt-righters because it seems to point, again, to Israel. Undeniably, a lot of it is the case. But this group is also interested in provoking World War III, as far as we can see, and simply possessing valuable things, nuclear secrets, for their own sake.
Power
for its own sake. And that's where the Satanism comes in, because the most natural human desire in politics is money and sex. But if you get to pure power to control people's thoughts for the heck of it, that's satanic, that's not human.
Right, okay. And on a related matter, you see, I think the public at large were introduced to this, well, lots of people who would never have heard about this or contemplated it before, were introduced to it really this time last year, a year ago, in the form of Pizzagate. And the thing that just preceded that, which was the spirit cooking thing. I mean, obviously, to a lot of people, including myself, this just seemed bizarre, like completely wacko. What would the three of you say about Pizzagate?
Well, it's very US specific and there's a lot of blind alleys. But what I think is, I would say, is that if it's bona fide, it's the American version of the control network, which in Britain would be common purpose. And so probably it's a good time for Brian to answer a lot of the chat room people to tell you what common purpose is. And if you listen to that through American ears, a lot of this will be relevant to what Pizzagate appears to be as well. And talk, I think, particularly about the sex abusers who've been found within common purpose.
Well, if I may, just before we sort of switch on to a common purpose direction, I'd like to say that this basic fact that people find it so difficult to understand that this stuff could actually go on, because it's horrific if you read into it, if you research it, the material is so dark, it's so unpleasant, it makes you feel uncomfortable. It makes a normal person feel uncomfortable. It makes them feel dirty. Now, this is one of the reasons why, of course, the police who handle child abuse cases and murders have to be very careful, because after a while it can damage them mentally just dealing with the subject. But to be real about this, we might find this very difficult to handle, but it is happening. We know that individuals can murder other people. We know that psychopaths might decide that they're going to torture somebody before they murder them. Thrill of it. So we know that there are people capable of doing despicable things. What this does is say, well, actually, some of this is going on within a system where people believe that they need to do it or are involved in doing it through a ritualistic, their own form of religious belief.
And including drinking the blood in the end, because if you die in a state of high panic, your blood is shot through with adrenochrome, which apparently gives a great power rush to the drinker.
So I'd just like to say to the audience, how have I got to know about some of these things? Well, simply by starting to talk to some of the child abuse survivors. Abuse is what you might say, this is a very black and white description, but you say it's normal abuse. This is the normal sort of stuff that child abusers do. And then you start to meet people who talk about being abused in a ritualistic setting. And then it takes on a very different turn because they're talking about the places that the abuse happened in, whether it's cellars or churches. Mm-hmm. They're talking about people wearing particular clothing. They're talking about animals being involved, and usually the torture of animals are part of what's taken place. And when you hear this from a person and they are talking to you directly, and you hear what they say, and you know that they can repeat quite very detailed information about a particular circumstance very accurately, they don't make mistakes, they repeat the same story, you start to pay attention to them. When you meet another person totally unconnected from another part of the country, or perhaps from overseas, who talks about the same thing, then you have to start to say that these people are talking about something which is real.
And not just real, but borne out by case law in every English-speaking common law jurisdiction and most of the continental ones. There have been convictions where the ritualistic and satanic nature of the abuse has been spoken of. Contact Wilfred Wong, or I think indeed Izzy's Promise, I-double-Z-Y, Izzy's Promise in Dundee, and they will tell you about the case law.
Yeah. So would you like me to switch across to common purpose?
Yes, indeed, because would you say that common purpose is still one of the main, your main concerns? Because it certainly was when I first encountered you 10 years ago.
I was so concerned at the time I stood up to be counted and started to talk out about it publicly. I can say that we are even more concerned about this organisation now, because although I think we did it some damage within UK, what we're now seeing is Common Purpose receiving more and more millions of pounds of money in order to spread its program worldwide. And so we've got Common Purpose programs now in Europe, within France or Germany, for example. But we've also got Common Purpose boasting of its work overseas, and a key area being in India, where David Cameron was happy to go public and back them. More recently, we've had Theresa May saying that she is personally backing the Common Purpose programs. We see Common Purpose moving across into Libya, funded by European Union money. This is a very, very dangerous and pernicious organization. And why do I say that? Because Common Purpose is reframing the way people think and behave in order to adopt a common purpose. And as a lady pointed out to me some time ago, she said to me with great confidence, well, of course, Brian, common purpose is satanic. And I said, that's very interesting because I haven't seen any direct evidence for that. And she said, but Brian, it's obvious. And I said, why? And she said, because if you look at what common purpose does, it is working flat out to take away free will from people.
It and says, the them of identity.
Says it's there to help promote, it's there to work in different countries. But if you actually look at what it is doing, it is reframing people in order to believe in one common purpose. And if you are not part of that common purpose, Chief Executive Julia Middleton herself has said in her book, Beyond Authority, if you're not with us, you're somebody to be coerced, you're somebody to be made to look an idiot, or you're to be sort of bulldozed over the way, out of the way, or run over. This is vicious politics, which is putting itself forward as a charity, but it is being funded principally by government and public money. it is very dangerous.
And some of the guys.
I think it's necessary. I think it's necessary to sort of zoom out and explain, like, to someone who's never heard of common purpose, what it actually is. But right. Before you do that, Alex, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'll switch straight to saying this instead. I will round that off first. Some of the people who were doing common purpose spotting of future leaders in Liverpool, for example, and who have been pictured hugging, although it's an awkward photo, but trying to get close to David Cameron and Michael Heseltine, the very important pro-Israel, pro-EU in the Conservative Party. These guys have later been convicted of wicked abuse of prostitutes and children. But now, what is common purpose? Well, US viewers might know that there's a fraternity called Phi Beta Kappa, which is rather dodgy, shifty, as you say, in America, because it only takes, you know, very elite brains of a certain from the main universities, the highest ones in the US. And there was no such fraternity of elites looking out for each other and making each other immune and promoting each other in Britain, because we had the old boys network of Oxbridge, and in Scotland you had the old universities and a closed shop establishment. And those were working just fine until things were broken open in the 80s. So in the Thatcherist era, what happened was a lady called Julia Middleton, who in those days had her maiden name still, which has escaped me now, but she was writing even in those days, was sent to the US to study the worst of tax-exempt foundation-type corporatism and how to get the workers to be like busy little bees and how to bully them each other into being more productive and all these themes. So the New World Order, another branch of the New World Order here, the idea of technocracy and emptying man's brain and making him a robot. And she came back in 81, I think, to the UK and was immediately promoted in London. And by 85, she'd started this outfit called Common Purpose. Who's Common Purpose? What is the Common Purpose? But by the late 80s, members of Parliament were asking questions in the House about how it had suddenly burgeoned into being present in 20, 30 cities, of which the city of Plymouth, where we're sitting talking to you at the moment, was one of the first. So perhaps Brian can tell you from his early experiences in the 90s when he came ashore from the Navy, what a provincial far-flung city like Plymouth, father set sail, very important in world history, what kind of state that had got into when the Royal Navy was being cut to the bone and common purpose networks were taking over.
And well, that is the place where my story starts, because principally I got interested in what was happening with fraud and corruption in Plymouth, and together with some other members of the community who wanted to try and do something about that, we started to speak out, we started to talk to people, a lot of information came our way, but with it came a warning from a man who said to me, I think your problem... the problem you're experiencing is driven by common purpose. And I'd never heard of that organisation. I didn't know what it was. I asked him to tell me more. He told me it was a charity, but actually he was very nervous of telling me more. And I had to go and research online to find this particular charity. What did I find? I found a charity which said it was there to create future leaders. It was talking about its common purpose, but that common purpose was never defined. And I then discovered that in Plymouth, a great many people who I rubbed shoulders with, at one stage I was one of the directors of Plymouth Chamber of Commerce. I discovered that colleagues in that Chamber of Commerce were common purpose leaders, but it was never discussed. It was never spoken about. I discovered that common purpose, in fact, was everywhere in Plymouth. It was in the police force, it was in the universities, it was in the local authority, the National Health Service, it was in schools, colleges. It was everywhere. But it was quasi-secret. When you knew where to look for it, you could begin to track people down. They didn't declare themselves openly. They had an advisory board. This was a group of senior common purpose leaders. This pattern was a template for other cities. So what I'm telling you about Plymouth, they did in other cities. But they had a board of senior common purpose leaders called the Common Purpose Advisory Board. And that advisory board scanned the city for other people they thought could be drawn into common purpose. You couldn't apply to just sort of ring up and say, I'd like to do the course next month and be on that course, because even if you made a direct approach to them, they had to vet you and they selected you to do the course. So this was a very, very pernicious course. It was easy to show that it was highly pro-EU. they had a, I'm going to say, an unnatural interest in school children. They were getting in amongst school children as young as 11. And what were they doing? They were running very skillful applied behavioral psychology in order to get children, teenagers and adults into a new political mindset. I'm going to call that reframing. Process was carried on across the country. Very, very keen to get people with control of money involved in UK. Because, for example, if you could get one of the financial officers for a local council as a common purpose trained leader, then they could have been encouraged to spend more of their local authority or the education budget on further training courses for common purpose. And on one of the websites that I set up, which is called cpexposed.com, you can see hundreds of documents revealing how this system worked, including letters where the local Common Purpose Advisory Board leaders were telling, for example, the head of the local police what he could say, what he should be saying, and also saying that senior public officials like the police, like chief executive officers from local authority, that they were, quote, the eyes and ears of Common Purpose. So here was a charity. Its objectives were clearly highly political. It was prepared to use applied behavioral psychology to get into the minds of people. And it was spreading itself covertly using public money. Very, very dangerous organization. But to me, the turning point, and Alex has alluded to this, was that when we discovered that within the Common Purpose ranks were paedophiles, Matthew Byrne is the...
B-Y-R-N-E, yes.
B-Y-R-N-E. He was on the Merseyside Common Purpose Advisory Group, and he was recruiting, of course, other Common Purpose members, and their recruiting efforts, of course, also went into schools and colleges. And eventually the man was convicted for the horrific torture and abuse of prostitutes and also paedophile activity. Any investigation of the Common Purpose networks, why not? Because, of course, Common Purpose is supported by the highest political levels in Britain. David Cameron, a backer of it. Francis Maude, another backer of it. And more recently, we've seen Theresa May boasting of her pleasure at supporting Common Purpose. So when people look at the United Kingdom and they think they understand what's actually driving the political system, what's driving policy, what's driving the so-called establishment, unless you understand organizations like Common Purpose, you're not even scratching the surface.
And this explains one of the, well, Common Purpose and Brexit are a little apart, but these control networks from within the establishment, and I grew up rubbing shoulders with the sons of the establishment at public school in Cambridge, and you hear the chatter from these boys talking about who really controls the country, then you'll see that Brexit is another example of the same thing. Mrs. May is having her strings pulled behind the scenes by a small number of banking and financial and corporate interests. And yes, there are, again, ties to Israel, but a lot of it is just certain corrupt continental elites and British elites cutting deals. Brexit's not going to happen as we expect it to. Military unification is being pushed apace.
Sorry to cut in a bit there, Alex. On the subject of banks, this is a very important subject because Julia Middleton never wanted to disclose which banks were the banks that originally funded the setup of Common Purpose. But we know that she's been highly supportive of Deutsche Bank. She was highly supportive of Lehman Brothers. The bank, of course, went bust. But for a long period, was crowing that Lehman Brothers bankers were an excellent role model for school children. We had her saying in her book, Beyond Authority, that East German bankers were wonderful people, some of the best people she'd met with phenomenal ideas.
The full title is Leading Beyond Authority.
So this is where we're really getting into the powers that are controlling our nations. And when we start to see our nations breaking down as a result of policy, which is alien to to the average person with some sense of national identity, these are some of the powers that are doing it. We could then move on to all sorts of charities and non-government organizations. The Young Foundation is immensely powerful. The Roundtree Trust. There's a
whole Demos, the think tank.
Demos, the think tank. There are now hundreds of these quasi-autonomous non-governmental organizations and charities which are driving the political agenda. And I'll just end by saying that if people don't understand what big society is within the United Kingdom, this was announced by David Cameron. Many people think it never happened, but not only did it happen, this is what is driving the political agenda, that instead of an individual making their vote being the key part of the sovereignty of the nation, what we've now got is third sector politics, participatory democracy. Organizations are the organizations being consulted by the government to form policy rather than what the individual on the street thinks.
This is why ethno-nationalists should be prick up their ears, because we have as our the inheritance of our peoples in the British Isles and the English-speaking world, the common law, with its presumption of innocence and its safety standards, its jury trial, and its justice being seen to be done, and all these other God-given and timeless principles. And these are being thwarted. On the continent, they've been thwarted by Napoleonic civil code. And in the English-speaking world, they're now being thwarted by networks such as Common Purpose, which sew up the judicial and policing system in a city at a time, and through the UN, ultimately, cause these to be city regions with their own cabals, with the police sitting in the same building next door to the judicial authorities. And so you won't get a fair trial, and pederasty will be easily covered up. So this is very much an ethno-nationalist issue.
Right. I think one thing that people might be asking is, obviously, we can say that this organisation and these agents of it engage in and facilitate child molestation. But I think the question is, what does all this lead to? What is the point of it? What is the point of all these little activities?
David is heading up a Scottish effort, which I think probably encapsulates why we do all this and what it's leading to.
Well, I wonder, Rose, do you remember the 1980s satirical puppet show called Spitting Image?
Yes.
They had a cartoon, a clip you may recall, where the Thatcher government sitting around the cabinet table, and someone mentions Scotland, and she can't remember what this word means. So she's going around the cabinet room trying to get reminded. And eventually Hearn says, up there, up north, Scotland, and he points at it on a map. Oh, she says, the testing ground. Now, that is more true now than it ever was then, because, and this may be to do with the nature of our people, because we're quite slow to anger. We're quite gentle. The nature of the Scots is that we're quite easy to govern. We're not prone to make a huge fuss. But this makes us easy to misgovern as well. And for whatever reason, the testing ground is what we are. Now, it was a surprise to me when I discovered years later a thing called the Scottish model of government, which came in 2007. Does that mean anything to you?
No, I don't know that term.
Yeah, invented by an Englishman.
I'm not actually surprised. Right? It came in 2007, and when you look into what it means, it's completely root and branch transformation of how government works. And nobody told anybody in Scotland this was going on. It was pushed forward by the civil service. It was pushed forward principally by a man called Sir John Elvidge, now I think running Edinburgh Airport, and he's also got a gig with the Carnegie Foundation, and does work all around the world, including Hong Kong, selling these same ideas. And what the Scottish model of government is joined up government to the ultimate degree. So departmental boundaries cease to have any real significance. Add to that all the major charities and third sector organisations, which are largely government funded, are co-opted into the same system. And you have a system where no matter how you as an individual or a small community interact with the state, you're at a huge disadvantage. Because if you interact with any aspect of the state, let's say education, you're interacting with health, you're interacting with police, you're interacting with housing, the information gathering potential of that, and this is part of the reason the name Person Fight has been so important in Scotland, the information gathering potential is simply enormous. So they can find out anything they want, essentially, about you or yours, and it puts the state in a completely unequal position against anyone trying to defend their rights, however ancient or correct those rights might be. So we're seeing this pushed forward in Scotland ahead, I think, of the rest of the UK, because we're such a compliant society, because we are, to a large extent, pretty good at governing ourselves and keeping quiet and not making a fuss. We're seeing this push come, and the effects are very strange. The effects are starting to be seen in fear. I've seen a lot of fear inside government organisations, and I've seen fear particularly in the faces of parents, because you're having to be very careful about what the state knows and who knows what and what could happen, because people realise that they are in this unequal position and they are in a vulnerable position. And of course, that's not the way we should be. It's not the way we should live. To live free means that your government is frightened of the people, not the other way around. And this is not something that is part of our culture historically, and it's not something that I think we should be rolling over to. I'll go what the UK column is about. One of the things I think we're about is helping people find ways to resist, helping people find ways truth out of being able to question those who claim authority over them and demand better standards and expose wrongdoing rather than being
subsumed, is it?
Good word, subsumed by the state.
So the ultimate point of all of this is a new form of government which is sort of psycho-totalitarian.
It's coming in by stealth. It is installing itself by stealth. This is the key thing. It's creeping in under the surface. People are beginning to be affected by it. So people will say to us, we know something's wrong. There's something not right. And they may be working in the NHS or they may be a school teacher. They know something's changed. They know something's not right, but they can't see it. And I think a lot of the work that we do is investigating and analysing and then attempting to show people what's happening in a simple, clear way. But we are watching a draconian, a vicious system of government install itself. The word communitarian fits the bill. Some people say, well, it's sort of corporate fascistic. Some people say it's Marxist. It's somewhere in all of those things. But it is utterly vicious. It does not want individuals. It doesn't want people identifying in proper communities. It does not want people identifying within their nation states. It does not want people identifying as man or woman. And this is one of the, just to push this point home, I will get people who contact me, and some of them have said, Brian, you're talking about the gays, you clearly don't support the gays. Well, what have I been saying? What I've been saying is that the gays are being used. They are a stepping stone. They're being used to break apart heterosexual families. They are being manipulated. They're being used in a very vicious way by the state. But the state is ultimately not going to take us to a point where a gay person can live in their community and amongst their group of friends in a comfortable way. No, because ultimately the state doesn't want any form of sexual identity. This humanism. And you can see this vicious policy now being pushed into the schools, where girls and boys are being told they don't really know what sex they are. But we are seeing a clampdown on disabled people. So 5-10 years ago, we had government policies. Everybody had to think about disabled access. We had to think about the needs of disabled people. This twisted stuff, because if you look at what the government's doing now, they do not care about disabled people. Somebody, it was Mike Robinson, showed us a, excuse me, an advert today. I can't remember the periodical, but it's quite
Newsweek.
It might have been Newsweek.
Yeah, the cover of Newsweek.
And Newsweek is saying, "Get rid of your granny."
Yeah, time to kill
right?
granny.
And we saw that, and we knew what it was. Somebody might like to check, but there's been a headline, I think, in the Daily Mail today, talking about 130,000. Elderly people being disposed of within the NHS. I'm going to say these figures are real, they're factual. We have got a vicious form of government which is installing itself a step at a time by subversive means. And I never, excuse me, I never forget the words of a very elderly German lady that I met, I think probably about 3-4 years ago in Bournemouth. She'd lived in Germany during the war. She was bombed out of Hamburg, and Bremen, I think, was the other place. Ultimately, she married a British soldier and came back to England. She was there with her cup of tea talking to us about life in Germany. And she said, the thing is that the regime installed itself a bit at a time. She said it was like drip, drip, drip of an anaesthetic. People were given more power, they were given uniforms, they were allowed to come into your house. So you saw the local station master, who used to be a nice person, changed. Now, that woman was very interesting. She was almost beside herself that we in United Kingdom couldn't see this happening, but she had seen it take over in Germany. And I'll also add, she told us many things where she was saying that what was said after the war, what they said was happening in Germany, true. And we paid a lot of attention to what she said. But her key point was that a massive change in the style of government in a country, we don't even have to say right or wrong, just the change was done by this creeping, stealthy approach a bit at a time. And that same approach is being unleashed not only in United Kingdom, but also in America. And indeed, I'm going to say the Commonwealth countries are a particular target. This massive change in...
And I wonder, Rose, Alex said earlier on that we share a fair overlap in audience. The reason for that is in part that the people in the alt-right are seeing some of the things which are forbidden, that are strangely not allowed, things that would be quite normal, examination of nationhood, of being a people, of having that identity and that community, that are being painted as somehow evil, and normal family life is being painted as somehow narrow and restrictive. These are the things that I see the alt-right reacting against. I think they're seeing some of the same things.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. I'll just ask questions that have been posted in the chat, and they don't flow directly from what we've just been saying, but nonetheless, we'll have to wrap up in about 10, 15 minutes, so let's try to get through some of these questions. What are your views on David Icke or David Icke? I never know how to pronounce his name.
Well, so happens that all of us here are Christians, and we wouldn't share David Icke's language of reptiles. But to give you a personal example of it, my parents, also Christians, were bickering about Icke recently. And my mother, who's very much a Middle England lady, said he shouldn't have said that our queen is a lizard. And my father, who quietly watches stuff and surfs online, he's 70 now, so he's been following it all the time. He said, "Oh, give over, woman. Icke was decades ahead of the rest of us, and he's been borne out in everything he said." And Brian has been a colleague of Ike's.
Well, I met him in the early days, and my first meeting with him, I was able to tell him what I discovered, and I wanted to tell him what I had discovered in my own words, because I got to a particular point and I said, well, this was before I'd even read one of your books. But I am also going to say that if you look at what he warned about, he warned about a vicious world system of government being put into place. He talked about the place of these extremely wealthy interconnected families within that system. He talked about them having a system of satanic worship. He talked about the abuse of children on a massive scale. He talked about the banking industry within the installation of this horrific agenda. And on all of those points, he has been absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. I would also add, as really alongside Alex, that David Icke talked about lizards. Easier to talk about demonology, because you can then rely on scripture to give you more detail and understanding. But David Icke has been very accurate on a very large number of subjects. Some of the things he talks about, I think to myself, well, I might be interested in reading it if I'm at home on my own. It's not something I want to talk about publicly, because I think it detracts from the most important thing. So I could have a discussion with somebody about UFOs. I could have a discussion with somebody about, is the moon hollow? That's not something I want to do in our daily news programs, because I want to deal with stuff where we can show real evidence about what's happening. So to his credit, David Icke woke up a lot of people to the fact that the world was not as we've been told. He's had a lot of extremely bad press. I can gently say that sometimes in his enthusiasm to tell all of his truth, as he's got it, he will go from one spectrum to the other very quickly. I would prefer to stay within the realms of news and documentaries on what we can actually prove to be going on.
And a colleague of ours in a different niche.
He did have the courage to publish while Ted Heath was still alive.
In 1998.
The allegations against Ted Heath, and that took guts.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And then another question. What about Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard? Would any of you want to comment on that?
Well, I think I should probably comment on that, because maybe that somebody in your audience has done some research and they know that I received an award from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is actually backed by Scientology. So let me now put that in context. In the very early days when I was talking about common purpose, I knew that in the common purpose training in psychology, I was seeing some people who had marriages wrecked by one or other partner getting involved. I'd seen some people becoming depressed or in other ways harmed in a mental sense as a result of training that they'd undergone. I began to look for answers. And one of the organizations I came across, without knowing too much about it, was CCHR. Please go and have a look yourselves. But they've done a huge amount of work to expose the abuses of the psychiatric industry, and in particular, the use of very, very dangerous psychotropic drugs, many of which have caused people to commit suicide, or indeed people to attack other people before they commit suicide. They've produced some absolutely brilliant books and video documentaries. And I began to exchange information with them. They weren't aware of common purpose. They were extremely interested in what I was seeing. I was interested in what they were showing. And having exchanged information for about a year, I was asked whether I would accept an award from them. Now, one of the things I would like to say is that we believe that if you are there to really find out what the truth is, you're there to find facts. We are prepared to talk to any reasonable person. You've kindly invited us on your program this evening. Many of your viewers have a particular view on the world, which I respect. I'm very happy to be here talking. I wouldn't say, no, I'm not going to go on that program because some of your listeners will
remove them from the gene pool, which they quit last year on the millennial.
Okay, we could discuss that. We haven't got time tonight. But the point I'm making is that that organization, CCHR, was doing immensely good work and helping people who'd been severely abused in the psychiatric system. And I felt that it was an appropriate thing to do. They wanted to give me some recognition for the work I was doing. I accepted it. Am I a Scientologist? No. Would I join Scientology? No. Do I believe that all Scientologists are bad? Absolutely not. Do I believe some of them are very bad? Certainly. But I think when we follow this path of getting to what the truth is, we have to keep evaluating people not by the label, but by their actions. It's what they do, and what, in some cases, what they say, but principally what they do allows you to see them. So I've put my hands up. I had an award from CCHR. They received money from Scientology.
By their fruit shall you know them, and that refers to individuals, including political figures.
Okay, and quite a few people want to know what you all think about Trump.
David.
Well, yes.
You've got 2 minutes.
I've read one or two articles about Trump for the column, particularly like called The Donald for First Minister, where I suggest that what we do is we get rid of Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP and we get Donald over on weekend golfing holidays. And we get him to run the country in his spare time.
Doesn't he already own all the Scottish golf courses?
Well, he owns a few. Because I feel that we would be better governed. We would be less governed, but we would be better governed. And the second one I penned was on the Syria missile strike, which I thought was perhaps a turning point. There was a lot of hope surrounding his election, largely because he wasn't Hillary. Hillary is so phenomenally corrupt. So in the pay of all the forces that we've been talking about here tonight, that anybody who would resist that was going to get a lot of support. And the whole year of 2016 with Trump and Brexit and everything, it was wonderful. I mean, it was a year of laughter. I don't know how you experienced this.
Yeah, at the time, yeah, it was.
Between Pepe the Frog and Kekistan and Donald Trump and Brexit, I spent, in political terms, rolling in the aisles for a good portion of that year. Mm. And it was a lot of fun while it lasted.
And you could feel it on the continent too, this slow awakening and becoming a bit Anglo-American in their political culture.
Now, what is he? You know, will he drain the swamp? I don't think he will, but he's at least pushing back against some of these issues. He is, he's not a racist, he's not a xenophobe. I think he's someone who would actually try to do the small man a favour. Right? And I think actually I've seen him do that once or twice, and I think the better of him as a man for that. I think a lot of the recent controversy over him retweeting the Britain First videos was simply him seeing an obvious injustice and responding as a decent human being would, and to say, look at this, isn't this awful?
And as regards the Dutch police one, the same problems that the British police have with the common purpose control networks, the Dutch have through similar networks. So that's why the young non-Dutchman in question beating up the boy on crutches was not prosecuted.
So in short, I don't think he's a saviour of the West, but I think he might slow things down a little bit. I think he'll allow a little time for people to find themselves. And if he comes to Britain, he's got an invite to come and see me anytime he likes.
All right. And the next question, do you expect conflict or blowback? Now, I don't know what this refers to, because it could mean blowback for your own activities, or it could mean conflict in society at large. So neither of those is a small question, but do what you can.
We're not going to get attacked because the establishment can't mention us by name, because as soon as they say this awful fake news site UK column, a lot of Middle England is going to find out what we're talking about. And because we talk solidly, the establishment is not going to like that. So the BBC and the establishment do their best to try to debunk our claims without referring to us. But more widely?
Well, I certainly believe that a prime objective of this system installing itself is violence on the street, because everything is geared up for that violence. We can see that the police have taken delivery of their new weapons. We've got our multi-shot tasers. We are seeing the British police becoming armed and paramilitary. We're seeing that all of the links into the European policing are also being tightened. Yeah. Brexit is the biggest lie ever told. There is no Brexit. Follow what's happening in policing. Britain is being tied even closer into the European military policing system, because it is military on the continent. But we've got the same thing happening in Britain. Why are they doing this? Why do they want the police armed? Because if they can kick off violence on the streets, they can get the clamp down. They can bring in any emergency powers that they want. And you can see this vicious state install itself more or less overnight. I know there are many people who feel very strongly that we should be sort of standing up and fighting. But actually, my view is, and I'm going to say this as an ex-military man, that the more measured, the more peaceful, the more persistent large numbers of the public are in exposing and simply saying, no, we're not doing what the government wants us to do, this puts them in a really difficult position. They can't smash you because they can't unleash streets. And look at what silent protests can really achieve. Syria was not bombed as a result of enough public saying, no, we're not having it. So there is immense pressure that can be put on the government and the political establishment. The exposure of the paedophilia, the demanding for answers, all of this, rather than violence. Start the violence, they will unleash the clampdown. Then you won't be able to meet in public, you'll have clampdowns on the internet, and they are more or less winning overnight. That's my personal opinion.
Read ukcolumn.org/defence for perhaps our strongest suit of reporting, which is about Federica Mogherini's plan at the head of the EU's foreign/defence ministry, basically, to roll NATO, in the European part of NATO, into European military. And then Britain will be in it seamlessly, and civilian military borders will cease. So you'll have militarised continent-wide policing, a military Schengen, basically, so people coming from one country to another. And most worryingly, perhaps because they've realised the danger of ethno-nationalism and other factors, meaning that our own young men will not join up or even not be conscripted. Because of that, both Macron and the Bundeswehr have said openly, well, we needn't restrict the membership of our gendarmerie and our military to young men of our own nation. Well, not even young men, young women as well, but we can open it up to Arab and African men.
God, that is absolutely terrible. Sorry, go on, Dave.
On the international side, working from that, you have the introduction of the sleeping beauty of the Lisbon Treaty, as Jean-Claude Juncker called it, which is Permanent Structured Cooperation, or PESCO. Mm. Now, what this is an EU military union, but it's an EU military union with an explicit political agenda, and that's to deploy out with the borders of Europe into the neighbourhood whenever European interests or values, whatever European values are these days, are being threatened. That's the start of something that I think we're going to see, and we're going to see increasingly become dangerous, which is more foreign entanglements and foreign wars. The reason that's not taking off just now is the United States of America, although its power is waning, still has enough power and enough of a navy on things and maintain the peace. When the United States of America is no longer able to do that, then there'll be a great deal of international conflict, international violence, and the most hotly contested part of the entire planet will be the Middle East, and in particular Jerusalem.
Plus, of course, the borderlands between Russia and Europe, especially Ukraine and Georgia. And there I fear brother wars, because the Slavs of Russia do not regard themselves primarily in terms of their ethnic identity, but as part of basically the last empire in Europe. That's a lot of Putin's thinking is basically imperial thinking and absorption of the Tatars and use of them. So you have real dangers that Russia is going with the Chinese and Israeli-based system, the Eurasian system, and that because of this, there'll be a clash with the EU. So there's a lot of danger ahead.
Okay, I'll just ask you, this is again from the chat, this is one last question, and I think this is coming from somebody who's trying to situate you in terms of a distance from the alt-right, or lack thereof. Is mass immigration treason?
Yes.
Yes, I would say it's quite clear that Blair, when he decided to bring in massive numbers of foreign people into the country for political ends, right, to rub the right nose in diversity, to coin his phrase or his advisor's phrase, and for a very distinct political gain, that would have to be qualified as.
There are groups which have been able to absorb and thrive under the common law. We've campaigned at Grenfell, or helped campaign at Grenfell, and notably the West Indian Christian community in London is very switched on to common law and wants to be patriotic British citizens. You can't say the same about some subcontinental groups like the Pakistanis, and it was known they were unintegratable before they came. So Brian addressed a meeting once, I think, of the BNP, didn't you? And you said, and someone asked you, you know, what about the treason? And you said, well, who brought them here?
Well, this is a very key point for me, because I wouldn't like any of the audience not to understand where I come from. Do I believe in my country? Yes. Do I believe that it has its own basic laws? It has common law. It has a constitution. It has a history. Do I expect that everybody that lives in the United Kingdom is white? No, I don't. I am perfectly comfortable with the idea that we have other people who come to live in the country. The word mass is the key issue in this, because this is immigration which has been used as a weapon to change the country politically. But I was invited to give a talk to a BNP audience up in the Midlands. This is probably about 5 years ago, and it was very clear very quickly that immigration was one of the key issues. So I asked a question of the audience. I said, how did these individuals get here? And there was a very long silence, and then eventually a very big man at the back of the room said, we let them in. And I said, wow, we let them in. You mean you let them in? To which he said a very rude word and said, I didn't let them in. And I said, okay, you didn't let them in. Did they fight their way ashore? Did they fight up the beaches? And of course, the audience had to say no. So then I asked again, who let these people in the country? But he said, our politicians did. And my reply was, who is your enemy, the politician who betrayed you or the person who was invited in? And from that point on in the meeting, I'm going to say we had an immensely productive discussion about what was really taking place in the country. Instead of rhetoric, instead of raw passion based on propaganda in the papers, we began to look at who had created the policy that had created the problem. I've also was invited to give a talk in Birmingham Central Mosque, which I was very happy to do. It was a fascinating experience, because while I was in the mosque, I could hear in side rooms imams talking about how families should conduct themselves in the UK. And they were pushing the types of values that I used to hear in Christian churches when I was a boy. I found some of the things I heard absolutely amazing. People being encouraged not to get involved with this and that. So we have seen this very, very clever play on people. We've seen policy which has created huge problems. And what does that policy do? It turns people against each other rather than focusing on the individuals that created the policy. The chairman of Birmingham Mosque at the time I gave that talk was a man called Dr. Nazim, and I invited him to come to Plymouth to talk to the audience. He did. He was quite nervous at one point because he said, Brian, the audience are all going to be white professionals. What do I talk about? And I said, talk about what you feel is right. And we then had the remarkable experience of this gentleman, Pakistani, second generation at that for him at that time. And he said all of the reasons why he came to UK. He was worried about the state of Pakistan. He was worried about whether his family was safe in Pakistan, opportunity to come to the United Kingdom. And when he came here, it was quiet, it was peaceful, it was organized. If you worked, you could get on. And then he said to the all-white audience, look at what your country has become. And it was a surreal experience. Here was the chairman of Birmingham Central Mosque in front of a white audience, clearly describing policies that had been brought into effect in the United Kingdom that had created a whole raft of problems for the average family. So I would like to end on that personal note, that the regime we're up against will pit man against woman, black against white, religions against each other. It will do anything and everything it can to make sure people are so preoccupied with what they see as the enemy, the real enemy, which is this hidden system of government, can do as it pleases. Mm.
That's a very good note to end on. But I do have one last question, because before we went on air, you were saying about how people can keep safe from the law, essentially. And Brian, would you like to repeat that advice?
Well, for me, people should, I would like to see, and hopefully as a result of maybe what we've said tonight, people can pick up, check on what we're talking about, don't accept what we're saying this evening, have a look at the website, check for yourselves what we're talking about. But if you begin to understand that there is something really unpleasant, we have got courts that are not courts, they're places of business, judges think they run the court instead of there being a jury to make the decision, for example. People have got to know the facts themselves, they've got to do the research so they understand the law and what they're up against. And then they should only push as far as they feel comfortable. We get some,
and not tweet when they're tired and emotional.
Yeah. So we get some people, they're so passionate, they go somewhere, let's say they attend a court to support somebody, they get caught up in the moment, then they start to use a bit of bad language at the policeman, and the next minute they've been arrested. And they've been arrested because they took it too far. It's much better to take your protest to the eighth degree, not the 10th, the 8th, pull back and have a go the next day than it is to take it further than you can deal with. And also do what you feel capable of. Some people, very gutsy, they'll get in the faces of the police and challenge them. They'll get in the faces of court officials and challenge them. But there are other people, that's too scary. And to those people, I say, that's fine. Do what you're comfortable with. If you can write a letter, send an email, be tweeting, you do what you feel comfortable with. And the bit we joked a bit about was, you know, if you're doing it late at night, don't do written work after you've had a few beers or a few glasses of wine.
Or an argument with the missus.
Or an argument with the...
because that should be the tweet that nails you. And for example, for examples to follow, you should look at the Twitter handles BrianGUKC, that's Brian here, and Albion_Rover, which is David Scott. They're very good at asking questions or making observations which are not, prosecutable in any jurisdiction, because it's just a chap saying, oh, isn't that interesting? I wonder what this means. And that's those discord.
I'll link to those Twitter accounts in the description, although I have to say they might only be useful for another 4 hours, because then it's the 18th and God knows what's going to happen on Twitter then.
Yeah.
The power of asking questions is very substantial. The power of understanding what lawful behavior is, and once you've internalized that, once you've really made that part of who you are, and you're able to go about your business knowing that you're operating in accordance with the law, not the legislation, with the law, the things that govern how we should be with one another. So you treat people with a bit of compassion. You treat them as politely as possible, but you're firm and you ask questions. And work from that, because the questions require answers. And often the answers give you far more information than you ever thought you would get. They're often condemned, the authorities are often condemned from their own lips. You can then make statements to them that you have this data point, you have the following data point, you've asked the following question. And then the reasonable man would conclude from this the following. And you can say, is this the case? So you're not accusing anyone, you're just saying what the reasonable man would conclude from the evidence that you have laid before them. And you can ask some pretty pointed questions of some extremely exalted people using that sort of approach and still be breathing the free air.
And I'll add to that a major tactic of the other side is to find an excuse to brand an individual as mentally ill. And if you are showing signs of aggression, so you're shouting, you're really getting in somebody's face, you're jabbing at them with a finger, most of the authority people now have been trained to deal with this. Mm. And what do they want? They want you to go that bit too far. They can then say, I think this man or woman's got mental health problems. The police then bring you into we could have another hour's discussion on this system, because it's not just the question you're banged up in a police cell. You're banged up in a police cell and then you get a mental health check. So this is very, very dangerous stuff. How do you stop this happening? It's this being very cool, calm and collected when you're dealing with individuals. Work it the other way. If you can prod in a cool, calm, collected way, you can get some of these officials to show signs of, and sometimes they can almost be on the verge of flipping. At that point, you say to them, I'm very worried about your behaviour. Have you seen somebody for a sort of mental health
check? And then they'll explode.
And this is applying psychology, reverse psychology. They're trained to deal with you as the mad right-wing extremist individual. If you stay calm and challenge them repeatedly in a very calm way, you can get them to this point of tension. Cognitive dissonance is the correct term for it, where they can snap. And at that point, you turn the tables again. You're saying, your behavior, I don't think you can be very well. This is immensely powerful stuff.
Two further quick points to throw in. Firstly, the use of recording, audio or video, is excellent because it proves what really happened. It also changes the dynamic of conversations. You'd be amazed how many bullying state officials are a whole lot less bullying when they know they're being recorded. And also the importance of staying out of their clutches. And this is something we've learned from the Robert Greene case. Once the state has got any sort of hook in you, however tenuous, then more and more things which are perfectly legal for you to do can be made illegal by the courts, and your room for manoeuvre and lawful action becomes ever more constrained. So the best thing to have is an entirely clean record.
If you can. All right. Excellent. Well, let's leave it at that. So this was Brian Gerrish, Alex Thompson and David Scott from UK Column. Thank you very much for arranging this. I know that it was quite logistically difficult, so I am grateful.
You're welcome. And our Twitter handles are in the chat room now, and you'll put them under the video as well.
Yes, I will. I'll link to them in the description. Some people are saying that the versions I put in the chat don't work, so I'll work out what's going on there. Okay, so the next one is with Pass the Noise, and that's in about 10 or 15 minutes from now. I believe it is. Yes, it is Pass the Noise. So, okay, thank you, UK Column, and thank you to everyone for listening. See you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.